Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. Hello and welcome to this week's Washboard Resonators Present, and this week we're revisiting Michael Messer because he has a guitar business that we didn't really talk about in his other podcast, but he has a new product available and we wanted to talk about it with him. Is that correct, Martin?
Yeah, so I've really wanted to sort of share what goes into producing his Michael Messer brand guitars because they are really good resonator guitars. I really genuinely believe that I can stand behind them, and I know a lot of people have bought them. But for a good five, six, 7 years, he's been working on something in secret, and the time has come to announce it. So do keep listening. We're going to find out about how he started the business, and then he's going to make this very special announcement about this new special product. Okay, then. So here we go. Michael has joined us. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Martin. Hello, Jack. Thank you for having me here.
Oh, thank you for coming along. This is something we talked about in your personal podcast that you did with us. We said we're going to talk about your guitar business in more detail, and here we are. So We've got two sides to this, and I'm really excited to share. We're going to share how you came to actually have your own guitar business. I think It's a really interesting story. But the second part of this, and this is the exciting thing, you've got a very, very special announcement that we're very, very excited to share.
I have a very special announcement.
My drum roll.
I'm not pregnant.
No. No, not yet, but you might be after this podcast.
I might
so,
well be.
Look, let's get into the business first of all. Yeah. Michael
Messer guitar. I'll answer anything. You ask me questions, I'll ask.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've told me this story on the phone anyway, and it's fascinating. A long time ago, I got to sort of, on a number of occasions, play your Michael Messer brand guitars, and I was always astonished how good they were and how well they played, especially when you know, compared to other, shall we say, like Far Eastern produced guitars. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the key thing, really. I want to know how you make guitars that are so good for such a good price. Take us back to the beginning. Where did you start producing your own guitars?
Okay, I'll try and do this kind of concisely and quickly. So back in the 80s and 90s, I used to write reviews for the glossy guitar magazines. Guitarist and all those magazines would come to me to review resophonic guitars. And along the way, I was very critical of pretty well most of the Far Eastern instruments, that they had all the right pieces, but they didn't know what to do with them. A bit like Eric Morecambe with the notes. You got all the right notes, but in the wrong order. And I'd said this a few times in reviews. And then when I got I started my forum, my online forum in 2003. And I would talk quite openly about this, more openly than I would for magazines in print. And I wasn't dissing the Far Eastern makers. I was basically saying, I was actually criticizing the customers, the Western customers, not the factories, because most of these things, when I got a guitar for review, I would find out, how was this thing made? How did they end up? How does Tanglewood end up making a guitar called a Nashville that has the most terrible sound and has got no connection to Nashville whatsoever? How does this happen? So I followed a trail, and I found out that basically how it went was, whether it was Tanglewood or various other companies, they would send a photo of a guitar to a factory in somewhere in the Far East. A company like Tanglewood has many factories producing instruments all over the place. They would send a photo and they would say, I want these, I want them as cheap as possible, as fast as possible, as many as possible. And they would say, the question might be, oh, do you want it to be a Dobro or a National? And they would say, I just want it to look like this. And I was quite open, you know, I spoke quite openly about this. And one day in 2008, a member of my forum, Robin Clark, who eventually became my business partner in the beginning, contacted me and said, I've read all your reviews. I'm really interested in your knowledge in the instruments and respect what you do and blah, blah, blah. And he said, I work quite near you. He was in the Air Force and he was based at High Wycombe. Mm. And he said, can I bring a guitar to show you? Yeah, sure. Come around one evening, bring me the guitar. And he turned up with a steel-bodied, no-branded, Far Eastern-built instrument that had many things wrong with it. But when I strummed it and played it, it was by far the best sounding and most faithful Far Eastern instrument I'd ever touched. That was the closest thing to a Nashville. And we took it to pieces on the kitchen table, and I explained to him what was wrong and why it was wrong. And I said, why have you brought it to me? And he said, I've been talking to these people. It's a little family business in Shanghai. They've just got going. They've only got a few customers. I've told them about you. They've looked you up online and they know about you. They'd be very interested in doing business with you. What do you mean doing business with me? I make records, you know. Well, do you fancy going into the guitar business? Go on, tell me, explain. Well, I would run the business, he said to me. I would do all the packing, the shipping and all of that, and the dealing with the money, and you would be Michael Messer, and you would design the guitars. And I said, well, go on, that sounds interesting. How much does this cost? And he said, well, I've done my maths, and for a small amount each, we can afford to bring in 50 guitars. And if we bring in 50 guitars and charge X amount for them, we won't lose our money. It's not a bad thought.
When was this? Sorry, did you say, Michael?
2008.
2008.
So he said, you know, he'd sort of thought this through quite well. And I said, you know, he said, what would you like to make? And I said, well, it has to be a 12-fret steel-bodied. That's the instrument that no one's ever cracked. And that's the one, like a duolian. Mm. And he said, okay, let's do that. And then he said to me, really, we should have a range. You can't launch a business with one product. So we eventually came to the idea of making two instruments, the Lightning and the Blues, the brass-bodied Stylo copy and the steel-bodied Duolian copy. No 14-fret, just two guitars, two 12-fret guitars. We paid our money and we crossed our fingers, and there were lots of emails backwards and forwards and photos and designs and measurements and all that stuff. And once we placed the order, I put word out on my forum. I had some drawings and I had some photographs of some prototypes that they'd made, and they're going to cost £495 each. And I'm going to be going into business. And there's not very many of them. There's 24 of each of them. And that's what I'm doing. Well, by the time they arrived in the UK, it wasn't 50, it was 48, because they come in fours. All 48 guitars were sold.
Already?
And we'd already placed an order for the second shipment before we'd received the first shipment, because people trusted what I was doing, a leap of faith, whatever you want to call it. I don't know. I couldn't believe that people were trusting me in that way.
Are there any significance to the names? You said the Blues and the Lightning. Why did you choose them?
Because we looked at all sorts of names for the steel-bodied guitar, and I can't stand all those names that try to be cool, like the, I don't know, if it's a blues guitar, let's call it the Chicago, or let's call it the Mississippi Delta model. It's like, please, do we have to? And then I didn't want my name on it. I wasn't going to call it a Michael Messer, and everyone, including Robin, said, you have to put your name on it. It's your name that will do this. And then I thought, well, it's a blues, let's just call it the Blues. Let's not be too, you know, let's just call it that. And then the Lightning, well, the Lightning design came about through me and Mark Makin talking, really. The first Style O's had a Lightning sandblasted design on them. And I was trying to not be like everybody else. And every company was doing palm trees. And so that's how the Lightning came to be. Thought it was a good name for a guitar. And that was it. It was born. They came into this country. The first 48 were gone. I had a couple of reviews done for magazines. Guitarist magazine made it the guitar of the month or whatever it was. Various other magazines I gave it to all raved about it. Back at that time, even 13 years ago, the internet wasn't as powerful as it is now. So it was still print was the way to go. And it just took off. And I never wanted to take over the world. I've never tried to expand it. I've had offers to expand the business and be in every high street in, on the planet, and I don't want to be. I just enjoy it the way it is, small, controllable. The first few years, Robin dealt with all the guitars. He did the shipping. He set them up and did all of that. And in 2014, he'd had enough. It had got too big for him. And he'd done a fantastic job, and he decided he wanted to throw the towel in. So he left it to me, he left the company and said, "You're on your own now," which I was a bit worried about at first. And then I involved Dave King, renowned luthier and an old friend. So Dave King does all the setups and I do all the packing and checking and finishing of. So every guitar, every MM guitar comes through me. And I'm very careful about what goes out. I'm very, you know, very serious about what goes out with my name on it.
How many have you put out so far then? So you had two lots of 48 come in.
Over 13 years later?
Yes.
Oh, heading for 2,000 guitars.
Very nice. And still the two models up until...
We've expanded a little bit. I've expanded. Still only two models. Well, no, we've now got only the Lightning is only a 12 fret model. The Blues is now two models, a 12 and a 14 fret model. And then I brought in 2014, I brought in a 12 fret wood bodied based on a 1928 Triolian, which I call a Blues 28. And then 3 years ago, I brought in a Blues 36, which is kind of based on a late 36 Trojan. So there's now five models.
For maybe people that listen to this that maybe aren't the biggest Resonator fans, you've kind of picked a lot of the classic models from back in the 20s and 30s and recreated them in this kind of, you know, this quality that you...
I only want to pay homage to the De Peras and what they created. I'm not interested in reinventing anything. I'm not interested in changing the design. I'm not interested in a newfangled version of it. I'm only interested in recreating as close as I can what those guys did in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. The reason I wanted to do the steel body guitar was because that was a budget priced instrument. The manufacturing is a process, and the type of factories that they had in the 30s are very similar to the way instruments are built in the Far East in small workshops. If you saw the place I went to, you know, when I started this off, I went to China, to Shanghai, to my guys there. And it was a wonderful small family business, hand building, mass producing, but by hand, which is how all those great Fender, Gibson, National, all those people back in those days, that's how they did it.
I said at the start here that, like, your guitars, from my opinion and lots of other people's opinions, are really the best Far Eastern guitars. Now, you've already mentioned that Dave King does the setups on all of them now, and Dave King, as we know, is a very renowned luthier. He doesn't take on work really now, does he, unless
No. He
sort of asks for it. He's very world renowned. And then you personally see to the guitar, so there's obviously a quality control there. Nothing's going to get past you that shouldn't go out. But what beyond that, what is it about yours that makes them as good as they are? Because you've specced these, a lot of these Chinese kind of or Far East factories, they're putting stuff out that's just the same spec with a different manufacturer's badge. Absolutely. On it. We've all seen them. So can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah, okay. First of all, before I move on to anything else, first of all, I talk about the people in Shanghai.
Yeah.
These people really know what they're doing.
Right.
The guy who owns the company, he's now retired and left it to his son. But basically, the history of Resophonic guitars from China came through him. whether you think they're good or bad, the Shaftesbury's, the Johnson's, all that stuff was all built in a factory that he controlled the Resophonic department. Okay, so he is personally responsible for everything that we've seen since the 70s come up through that route. So he knows his stuff, okay? And also the guy that spins the cones, which is, we all call them continental cones. That's really our word. They're not really continental cones. They are continent. They're cones built by a guy for a few workshops, of which some of those are built for me to my spec and some for other cuts. But continental cones is really what we call them, okay? There is one guy making all the cones that come under that umbrella of continental. And he hand spins, and he's an expert spinner. So, okay, that's that. That's them. And these guys know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Then you bring into the equation Robin Clark. Now, Robin didn't have a history in resonators, but he's a skilled guy, good engineer, definitely had a good head for getting an understanding quickly of it. So then you've got Robin and me. Now, my history, I don't need to explain in this. My history goes back more than 40 years with resonator guitars. At the time, it was less because it was 13 years ago, but my history doesn't need to be explained. My close friends were very important in this. First of all, we've got Mark Makin. Yeah. Mark was very, very instrumental in this, very, you know, in the look of it, in the product names, in the colour, the way that the blues is sprayed, the colour of that. Mark had a lot to do with that. We talked for many, many, many hours. You know, Mark and I probably talked about this far more than Robin and I talked about this. Then my other very close friend is Mike Lewis, fine resophonic guitars. Arguably the finest luthier building resophonic guitars in the world today.
I concur.
So I had a lot of help. It wasn't just me. It was all these different elements coming together to make it really, really good. And the thing is, what I always maintained, which was really my point in the whole thing, was that National Duolians were made for a few dollars. They were cheaply mass-produced, and they were incredible instruments.
Yeah.
I see no reason why today, in a factory that is charging less than they charge in the West to manufacture, I see no reason why we can't make a budget-priced instrument as good as a National Duolian.
Yeah.
And I think we're pretty darn close, and only time will tell. When they're 70 years old and 80 years old, maybe people will look at those MM guitars in a different way.
It must be rewarding to be able to manufacture an instrument that's that good and that affordable. Do you get a lot of feedback? Do you hear from people?
I get incredible feedback. I don't have a click to buy thing. I like to communicate with my customers. They have to email me. We have an email conversation. I'm often advising them which model to get, because a lot of people have never owned one of these instruments before. I've always wanted a resonator guitar, which one to, you know, and so that happens. I like to keep it small and controllable.
It must be amazing. You know, I know how much you love resonators. So to be this involved, to literally spec and get produced guitars that are as good as they can be because you know what went into the old ones, it must be a nice feeling to give the musicians, the guitar players of the world, a resonator that sort of sits, you know, way below the price of a decent American-made instrument.
Absolutely that.
And, okay, a bit more than the usual cheaper stuff, but yeah, affordable for pretty much everybody. You know, that was a nice thing to do.
But you know, it is, and it's also a funny thing. As you get older, I kind of enjoy giving something back. It really is very touching when I get an email back. I got a lightning this morning, and I can't. I'm really blown away with it. It's amazing. I didn't think it was going to be this good, and for me that's everything. And yeah, of course, it's nice to make a little bit of extra money. And as a professional musician, it was certainly one of the reasons I went into it, was because it was, I could see another income coming in that was a little bit more reliable maybe than making records and doing gigs. But I never wanted it to take over. It hasn't taken over. And I really enjoy where it is. I really enjoy doing it.
It sounds beautiful. It sounds like a very happy place to be. Yeah. Which brings us to the next stage, Michael. So here is a big announcement for your brand. Now, you've been working on something, and it is spectacularly exciting for us Resonator people. So tell us what you've been working on for the last number of years.
Okay. I'll take you back to the beginning, and I'll try and do this as quickly as possible.
Okay.
When I first got into playing resophonic guitars, resonator guitars, I used to go to the Half Moon in Putney in London, and I used to see Sam Mitchell play.
Yes.
And I loved Sam. I loved him as a person. I loved the way he played, and I loved his guitar. And Sam played what we now call a fiddle-edged dobro. Yeah. A metal-bodied, called a fiddle-edged dobro because instead of being soldered, it's rolled like old car bodies were, or like a baked bean tin or sardine tin is made in a way.
On the edge, the edge of the body is like the metal's rolled together.
Yeah. And there's no solder.
No solder.
And it has a spider cone, and it's a dobro rather than a national. When I started this business off in 2008, I had this thing in my mind about making one of those.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a fiddle-edged dobro. Move on a few years. In about 2012-13, I start to get a little bit more serious about it. And I'm not an engineer, so I don't know how things are done, okay? I don't know how cars are welded together or anything. I don't know how metal is formed. That's not my expertise. So I started inquiring and asking, and there was a guy on my forum really helpful to me. He explained about swathing machines and how metal is formed in that way. And I then kind of went into it a little bit and realized, this is an art form that's gone, a technique that doesn't exist anymore. This isn't going to be easy to do. Move on a few years, early 2016. I start looking for people who know about rolled edges. This is more important. This is as important as creating what I'm about to show you. Anyway, I found out how this was done. A guy in California that put old 1920s cars together and put the wheel arches and the running boards on them. And he explained, this is the same as that. This is also the same as ammunition containers were made for the First World War and the Second World War, that kind of thing. So I then started to want to do this and do it properly and make a fiddle-edged dobro as a Michael Messer instrument. And I suppose that before I go any further, I probably should show you.
Yes.
Because I have now got, this goes on the market within a few weeks. By the time this video comes out, it probably will have just gone on the market.
So we're filming this or recording this at the end of February 2022. So you're probably March or April, you will have some brand new fiddle-edged dobros for sale for the first time since the 30s for sale.
No one has made this instrument since the 1930s. Now, what I need to say about this is that I have made this, if you look at the back of this.
So you're holding up, just for the podcast, you're holding up a brand new, shiny one of these beautiful fiddle-edged dobros.
Just to prove it's not a real one, I've got another one here.
A matching pair.
So, yes, I'm just going to hold one for a minute. So I need to explain a few things about this.
Explain away.
So my people in Shanghai were not the people to do this, because this wasn't the sort of thing that they were prepared to take on or interested to take on, because it went somewhere else in the whole way this is constructed and everything. So the first thing I had to do was find someone who would make these for me. And I didn't want to do it in the guitar world. I wanted to do it away from the Shanghai Guitar Network, because It's very easy to lose control and be copied. And I realized that without a neck on it, this is a metal box built to a certain specification. So a friend of mine was helping me, and he found this company owned by an English guy who lives, funnily enough, down in the southwest of England and has a factory in China that build very high quality metal stuff. I met with them. I had some drawings. I had the blue guitar. I showed them it. And I said, I want to do this. Their chief engineer explained to me how difficult it would be and that, are you aware of what you're going into? And I said, not really, no, but if they could do it, we can do it. Surely with today's technology, we can do this. So the first thing to do was to do tests. They did tests to see if they could get this roll right, okay? And this was before any design or anything. And they realized that to get this roll as good as they did it in those days, it would have to be done by hand, like opening a giant can, and it would take at least 9 turns around the guitar. You have to go around it each time you bend it a bit more. Massive, massive undertaking. And they also said to me, the engineer said to me when he was there, he said, you know, the amount of wastage in that factory, he said, it can't have been worth them doing it. And I said, they can't have wasted it. He said, I'm telling you, to get that waste, and that's not a pun, but to get that part of the guitar as good as that with the roll, he said, they must have trashed loads of them. Well, we all know that original ones are very rare. I now know through what I've been through in the last 6 years producing this, I know why they're that rare. Because believe me, this was not easy. This was a mammoth undertaking. I can't tell anyone how difficult this was to produce.
Yeah.
So I bought an old one. I sent it to these people that make the bodies. They started copying it, realized that what we had to do was scan one and get scans off them and start going from there.
Wow.
We had scans done of parts of it, and then pieces made. And I'll give you an example of what I went through. These are printed 3D prints of cover plates. This is a bendy, flimsy one.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, this is a bit more thick, and this is absolutely perfect. A plastic 3D printed with the screw holes, with everything as it should be, fiddle-edged dobro cover plate. Of course, we know fiddle-edged dobros have 3 rows of sunset, not 2. Makes them very different. There are also some things I needed to redesign on this because there are inherent problems in originals that I wanted to get away from without changing any originality, but just making some adjustments to make it a little bit more user-friendly. Originals, the cover plate is very tight on the spider, almost touches it, and the bridge quite often does on some of them, is really, really close on there. So we adjusted, once it was scanned, I slightly adjusted the cover plate so we had a little bit more space for the bridge and for setups and stuff. This is absolutely dead on to the real thing, okay? It's slightly narrower, and I did that for a reason. I've always had a problem with them. Some of them can sound a bit tin can-like. And the research I did, having so many wonderful friends that, you know, Dave King, Mike Lewis, and various people that I spoke to about the whole construction of resophonic guitars and seeing some of the deeper bodied instruments produced by National, I decided the only change I wanted to make was I wanted to go slightly narrower, a bit more like a National, but not as narrow. Okay.
So what does that do then to the sound?
Takes away a bit of the tin canniness of it, tin can sound.
Okay. It tightens it a bit.
Yes. So compared to an original, it is a little bit narrow. 4 mil, something like that. Not very much at all.
4 mil.
But it's enough to take the boxiness out of it. It was enough. So
while you're on about the sound, can I ask a stupid question? I know this podcast,
please ask.
People who are really interested about these guitars and know all this already, but so having that rolled edge, is that a different sound to the welded edge? Why is it so important to have
this? Not particularly, but the DePeras went into it in the 30s because they were having problems with the soldering. When they polished the guitars and the guitars got hot, they pop open on the sides. So, hey, let's do it without soldering. So they found a company to produce these and said, we don't need any solder. What I now know is that the reason there were so few of these made in the 30s is because the guys on the shop floor said, sorry, we can't make any more of these. This is impossible.
It was like a very noble experiment, I feel, that they were like, oh, you know, maybe if we can get the tooling in the factory, we can produce guitars perhaps quicker by basically crimping.
That's what they thought it'd be faster and cheaper.
Faster, yeah, which is, and they were wrong. Do we know, just before we go on to this, the story's fascinating, Michael, do we know how many were made back in the day?
No, but we do know that we've, between all of us and everyone that we can get together and ask how many they've seen, there's probably less than 1,000. Now, it was always going to be a limited edition because I just wanted to do it to prove that I could do it for myself and to create this wonderful thing. So the original plan was to make 500.
Right.
Okay. After 2 years of the factory having attempts at making them and having problems, the next problem that happened was they had to make a jig to put inside it, because once they put the back on to put the top on, they were crushing the sides. And then they were sending me photos saying, we can't do this, we're crushing all the sides. I said, well, they did it, what do we do now? They invented their own jig to put inside so they could put the top on. Then we were off again. I was getting photos of piles of these just trashed, just useless. So then it starts to get going. I said, and of course, money's going into this. Mm. Huge amounts of money. It's not cheap to do this. It's cheaper than in the West, but we're talking huge amounts of money. The price of a small house, you know, in some parts of the world. It's a serious, serious thing to take on. And they knew that, and they were really helpful, these people, because they wanted to get me through it. And eventually, in around 2019, they said to me, and of course, then lockdown caused all sorts of problems. In 2019, they said to me, we reckon we can get you 250. And 250 turned into 220. And there are 220 of these, and there will never, ever be any more.
Oh, they're not making any more now?
No, there are 220. They are a limited edition. They will never, ever be any more. And I can't go into pushing them any further because it's too difficult to make these bodies. Once the bodies are made, then we can make the necks, and we've got, you know, the beautiful, with the Michael Messer, you know, the new logo and the whole thing. These are beautifully made one-piece necks, and it's all properly done. The neck was designed, copied from the real thing, designed by Dave King. The first pattern was made for them by Dave King.
That little rounded top that the Dobras have.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely. Mark Makin designed the decal, and the idea of that was that we were going to pay homage to Regal, to Dobro, to all of those, but we're not copying. So the colour, the gold, the orange, the green.
Beautiful,
and it's not a laser print. It's not a computer print. This was done by someone that screen printed. It's proper gold ink. This is the real thing. Oh. They were handmade decals. And the whole process of this has been no corners cut, everything done as good as we can possibly do it. The spider I had, we laser scanned a real one. And then we sent it to people that made the body. And I'll give you some examples of the kind of work that we put into this. These are the drawings that they produced from the scans.
So what you're showing now is the part of the resonator system, which looks a bit like a spider's web. And now you've got these 3D scans printed out and all the stuff there.
Yeah.
Amazing.
This is that when it was made, still in its mold.
So that's in the actual mould itself?
That's in its aluminium mould before it's
the resonator. Wow.
It's amazing stuff, this. It's amazing. The quality of that spider in there, I don't have one to hand at the moment, but the quality of that spider is the best I've ever seen. You know, they're often rough, so this is a smooth, beautifully made thing. Here's another laser print thing. This is a tailpiece. We scanned the original because we wanted the dimensions and everything to be exact. But then we thought we'd use the M in there somewhere.
Oh, so yeah.
Just a little tweak on the original design of the tailpiece there. Yeah,
no one can take any parts of this. Hidden under this tailpiece, which all looks normal, when you take that away, you have an M in your cover plate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Your body between the two spokes of the in here. There's an M embossed there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, nobody's bootlegging this.
This is a really interesting point, because I think we've spoken in the past about these kind of fire racing guitar businesses. Basically, I believe it's the case that somebody can go and have something made in China to their own spec often, and then it just ends up on the market, basically.
Very difficult.
I know you've got special arrangements with your factory so that your spec kind of is looked after, otherwise there's problems there. But so same here. So you future-proof this so people can't produce anything, any of these parts or anything off the back.
Absolutely. And, and I didn't produce it in Guitar Town, as they call it, Shanghai. The dies are 2,000 miles away from there.
Mm.
So those dies don't exist in Shanghai. So, yeah, this is a very... This is a very lovely sounding instrument. And it's always very easy for the manufacturer to talk about how wonderful their product is. and I hate doing this, because not hate talking, but I hate what I'm about to say, but this is true. In most cases that I know of, with the brass-bodied ones, these are coming up as good as the best of the vintage ones, and it's in lots of cases better. This is quite a loud guitar. One of the reasons a lot of people don't use these on stage is because they're not particularly loud. Whereas this is very, very loud. It's a very sweet sounding guitar. It's got a lot of volume. It's got everything you could want from an instrument like this. It's very dobro-y. If you play it as a dobro, it's got a very dobro-y kind of.
Beautiful. So you're playing that on your lap there. It suddenly made me think that, like, a lot of bluegrass country kind of guys play dobros on their lap. Are you doing square neck versions or just round neck versions? Is there anything?
There's only round neck. There may be. At the moment, the position we're in is, when I say there's 220, there's 220 bodies.
Right.
Okay. The first 40 guitars have just arrived in the UK today.
Oh, right.
They haven't cleared customs. Today is the 16th of February, 2022, and the first have arrived at Southampton Docks and will clear customs over the next few days.
So it just so happens that we're recording this day that they've arrived in Britain. Wow, okay.
Whether I make some as square necks, I'm not sure yet.
I think it's really cool, Matt. I think you should be proud of doing this, because I think I can see why it ticks out of the boxes of me and mine as well, because you like... people who like these kind of niche things, and this is just really a labour of love, I imagine.
Totally. I can't tell you.
And you've gone the full way. So
I can't tell you how much. I can't thank you. I can't tell you how much work has gone into this, and how many. We are talking 6 years of, and being told for certainly the last couple of years of it. Okay, 2020 went a bit weird, but between 2018 and 2019, the factory basically saying, we're struggling. We're not sure if we're going to be able to finish this.
Mm.
The owner of the factory was so supportive and helpful that he could see what was invested in this, and he kind of said, "We've got to produce some, because the guys put a lot of money into this." But we got there, and as I said, you know, no one's done that shaping on the back of a, no one's done that. That's proper, like an old national.
So just to explain for the people that are just listening only, so the back is all like domed out and really beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, this is really, really as close as I can get. It's got the offset spider, which means it's not a 14 fret, it's sort of off, just off, you know, it's not quite the right scale length. You look at them up close and there, see, it's, which is exactly like the real ones, which was a mistake. They made a mistake when they designed them in the 30s. They, when they did their measurements, they didn't incorporate the roll, so that the, because the side is actually deeper than it, so they screwed it up, and so the scale length was wrong when they made them, and that's why they ended up making these offset spiders.
Yeah, they had to place the bridge in a different place because calculations. So you've even copied the 1934 mistake.
Oh, had to. Another lovely thing that we've got happening, I don't have any yet, we're still running some tests, but we're going to be doing some sandblasting ones like the originals, and our dear friend Mark Makin has designed this.
So this is, okay, so what, let me explain to people here for the podcast. So what we've got here is you're holding a picture with some etched design. So if anybody knows about resonator guitars, you've seen the Mark Knopfler guitar with the palm trees on it. So you're holding a design there with, is that a swan?
Yeah, they're swans.
They're swans, and there's like a really beautiful Art Deco kind of geometric pattern.
Yes, or it could be flamingos. It could be flamingos, swans, flamingos. It's a beautiful Art Deco thing.
But you're going to, or flamingos, yeah, sorry, swans. What Mark's designed for you there, you're going to have some etched fiddle edges with a brand new design, Art Deco design on it.
Yeah.
So are you going to have some plain ones and then the etched ones?
Yeah, we're going to do plain like this. And then we're going to do some with that sandblasted design. At the moment, there is only that design. If it turns out to be popular, maybe we'll do another design. I don't know at this point.
That's cool. So you just, I guess you'll see how it goes from the first batch then. So are they all brass bodies, or are you doing different body types?
All brass. We wanted to do some steel, but because they had so many problems, steel is much harder to bend and work than brass.
Oh, right.
Like, seriously so. And when I suggested to them, can you do some of steel? It was like, come on, guys.
Yeah, don't push it.
Exactly that.
Yeah. I mean, this is just amazing. You brought the olden days back to life.
So, yeah, this is the first time since the 1930s that anyone's done this.
The process of reproducing these beautiful instruments, what's it taught you about Dobro and the National Factory back in the 30s and the DePira family and their kind of sort of inventive engineering kind of brain?
Well, it showed me, first of all, the genius of John DePira.
Yes.
And his family, and his, you know, no question, because there were a lot of things in this that the whole idea of it was to make production easy. This has a ramp built into the top of the body. The body's not flat, so instead of having to angle the body and to get neck angles and everything, it's built in. So there were things that they designed into this for quick production. The only thing is they didn't take in that you actually can't produce it quickly. So their wonderful idea was a little bit of a harebrained mad invention.
So they must have seen, like you say, those ammunition kind of boxes that we've probably all seen in like antique shops, really cheap, and gone, oh, you just basically crimp and roll the edge. You run some tool along the edge of it and it just crimps it all together. We do that around the guitar, but the curves of it, from what I understand, it kind of buckles the metal on the top and the sides, and it crushes it if you don't get the pressure quite right. You need a lot of formers inside, otherwise it all collapses in. So they didn't take into account the curves. They were just seeing square boxes.
Yeah, I think so. And also,
which are quick to make.
Things that make the strength, like the way this is rolled in. For example,
so we're looking at the holes on the...
The holes, the gun sights, the windows. The way the metal rolls in had to be, because it all creates strength. Mm. And the first samples they sent me, you know, was just flat. It's like, no, that's no good. It's got to be properly. So I ended up inside an old one taking pictures, showing them the measurement of how far that rolls in, the way these three holes roll in, I mean, I can't tell you every single piece of this instrument. What did it teach me? It taught me that the De Peras were incredible inventors, but they weren't incredible at the other side of it, which is the production. Right. That's why they needed business partners. And that's how George Beecham came along.
If people want to get one of these, how do they do it? And when can they do it?
They contact me via my website. These are more expensive than a regular Michael Messer guitar, but this is not the same sort of thing at all. As I say, this is a one-piece mahogany neck. The amount of work, time, and money that's gone into this, I don't think anyone can deny. And the collectability of a limited edition. So these instruments are going to be sold, obviously, in a nice case and everything. These are going to be £1,795, British pounds. That is, believe me, that's as cheap as I can do it without being a charity. We are looking at something that you will never see again. Nobody's ever done this.
Worth every penny.
This is a very beautifully built, amazing instrument.
Jack is a drum collector and a washboard player and a drum, drum genius. Jack, when you look at that Dobro guitar, because obviously I use Nationals and you know all about Nationals, what do you think when you look at that? Do you think that looks nice? Do you like the design of it? What do you think as a layman?
This is a moot point because there's going to be guitarists listening to this, so hopefully you know what I'm about. But I just love the history of it. And it's like I say, I've never done anything like that, but I've put my heart and soul into projects for a couple of years as well, and it's like actually trying to realise them. So it's just really cool. I love that you've repeated some of the mistakes, and corrected some of the other ones. So it looks different to me, because I'm just saying different because I'm used to seeing your Nationals. I wouldn't be able to tell you, but it's just that I think that's really cool and definitely worth if you can afford it and you want a piece of that history. So it's not going to come back, and it's like, they'll be around another 100 years, hopefully, and they'll be as collectible.
Absolutely. No, it really became a labour of love. And I didn't know I was going into that. I actually naively thought it would be quite easy. Beautifully built, beautiful sounding guitar.
It truly is. So, we're coming to the end here, Michael. So is there anything else that you'd like to add about this?
I don't know what to say. And do you know what's really odd? I tell you what's odd. Reaching the point now where this is finished, where I'm now selling it. It's nice. It's a bit strange. We are talking about 6 years' work here. And anyone who doesn't know about how you turn something in from an idea into a reality, 6 years to make that? Come on. But believe me, the work that went into this, the time, I haven't come to terms with the fact that they're going out as a product now, but they are. By the time this video's out, about the same time these things will be launched. You've had one of these instruments, haven't you? Did the one you have the F-holes or these concerts?
Yeah, so I borrowed one, a gold sort of plated one that had been messed about with and had a new neck on. That one had the F-holes and it had been converted to a normal National-style biscuit bridge from the offset.
Oh, yes.
Over a spider bridge.
Oh, the inside of this, you just reminded me of something. So the sound well is exactly like an original. It will take both cones. It will take a 10.5-inch spider Dobro cone and it will also take a 9.5-inch National cone and biscuit bridge, not at the same time, but so it's exactly the same.
It's a really good point again. Back in the day when the De Peras were designing these, they designed it on purpose so you could put either cone style in, didn't they?
Yeah,
and you've done that,
yeah.
So are you going to be just selling the Dobro style cone, or do you think you might even do some national cones?
Well, I've got one. I meant to bring, should have brought it down. I've got one upstairs with a national cone in.
But so you'll be able to offer either.
It sounds great. If anyone wants a national cone, they can have a national cone. Yeah.
Oh wow, this is amazing. Well, look, I think we'll bring this to a close. What an incredible journey you've been on to recreate a labour of love.
It's an extraordinary journey, and thank you for interviewing me about it.
I'm just really glad that we can share this, because you know, you've told me about this, and I've kept it under my hat, and it's to me it's one of the most exciting kind of things to come up in the Resonator world for a very, very long time to recreate this. And I think when this drops, it's gonna surprise and shock a lot of people. And what I think nobody will understand is what's gone into it. And I know that even just now, we've spent about maybe 40 odd minutes talking about this guitar. We've spoken on the phone about this, and you've gone into much more detail. Like, it's so much more complex than people understand. But I hope that people get an idea of what you've had to do to do that. Yeah, I think it's amazing. I commend you wholeheartedly for doing that.
I know, there's nothing like this. No one, and I don't think anyone else will go into producing anything like this, because I actually would say don't, because this is a really very difficult thing to do, and I had no idea when I started. The one person that did know was the first engineer I met at that first trade show in London. He came over from China with these people that made this. He was a young guy, had just finished university. He was a really nice guy, and he looked at the original blue one, and he said to me, "This is really difficult. This is." I said, "Come on, in this day and age with all your technology." He said, "You have no idea." He was the one that was right.
Well, yeah, exactly. So if the shipments arrived today, you're going to wake up tomorrow. What are you going to do then? Start trying to recreate the old Dobro banjos or something like that?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing tomorrow. Yeah, we're doing that. I think we'll the John DePiro
violin.
Yeah, I think we'll do that. And then we'll follow that with the John DePiro double bass, I think.
Yeah, I've seen that. whatever the weirdest, stupidest kind of ideas that they came up with.
Exactly.
Well, look, let's bring this to a close, because I think we've got a great plot to tell. Thank you for sharing this. I'm really honoured, and you know, even Jack's interested, and he plays drums.
Yeah.
So well, let's just say thank you very much.
Well, thank you,
Michael Messer, and we'll say goodbye for now.
Thank you. Yeah. Just one thing before you go, I want to thank you guys for doing this, and for all the stuff you do, interviewing people, making your videos about Resonator guitars and about drums and the whole thing. What you guys are doing is amazing.
We're just two small hairy ginger men that are just messing
about. There is that too, but you know, the whole thing that you're doing with your online presence and your Washboard Resonators duo is superb. So it's a wonderful thing.
Thank you very much.
It's a wonderful thing. Yeah, you can
pay me. I feel embarrassed now.
Bye, everybody. Bye. Fantastic.
Bye. Okay, then. So there we go. Very exciting, very interesting news for all us Resonator people. So if people do want to find out more, they can just Google Michael Messer. He's got a website, and that's where you'll find his guitar brand. And
MESSER, right? Michael Messer.
That is correct. And you heard what went into that. So, I don't know why anybody listening to this to the end wouldn't want to go and buy one just to support all that excellent work.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So thanks very much for listening. Yeah. And come back next week for next week's guests. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.